I find a lot of the discussions about needing more women in professional positions, CEOs for example, to be slightly disconcerting, because they can partially seem like calls for more women to affix their self-worth to employment and career. When that happens, neoliberalism will have swallowed everyone up whole. Both sexes will be equal, of course, but equal gears in a very dismal machine.
We're talking about what a more feminine economy looks like on this episode of The Gender Knot, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. My name's Nastran Tavakoli-Farr, and I'm your host, but it's all good, call me Naz, and we're trying to figure out gender roles for our modern era. This episode is about what a more feminine economy looks like. Right now, it's all about how the future is female, that slogan that seems to be everywhere. But what does it really mean for the future to be female?
If the future is to be truly female, we will need women to transcend the very state of affairs that make corporate executives such powerful positions in the first place. These women will need to ask, why do we structure our enterprises the way we do, and for whom is this still useful?
And instead of simply having more women in top positions, what does it mean to have more feminine values in the workplace?
Understanding intuition, valuing it, knowing that it's just as valid and worthy as important and important as hard science. It means recognizing that power isn't finite, that the whole concept of abundance is that power is not a zero-sum game. It means creation.
There's talk daily about getting more women into the upper echelons of all industries, making sure that there are more female board members for our biggest companies, pushing to have more women in science and tech, closing the gender pay gap, seeing how we can have women not drop out of the workforce after they have children, and much more. Now, I'll tell you straight up that this episode is super special for me because I studied economics, and I'm a bit of an economics nerd, so this whole topic about the very nature of the economy is one that is fascinating for me, both intellectually and conceptually, and also in the real world. After all, the economy is real and it affects all of us daily. And when it comes to the workplace, it's an exciting time. What will the world be like if more business leaders are women, and if there are more women leading our biggest industries? For women like me, most of us have grown up knowing that we'll be going into the workforce and that being a working and earning member of society is empowering, and that we should be striving to be the best if that's what we want and that no one can stop us. But I've come to feel a bit mixed about all of this. Now, some of the sentiments I want to raise also appeared in the episode on leaning back and lean in, so I'll try not to repeat too much here. But speaking for myself, while I'm hugely ambitious, I've come to grow skeptical of what it takes to get ahead in the workplace. It's not that I'm not ambitious, because I am, and massively so, but that getting ahead at work often involves behaviours which I'm not really a huge fan of. I've talked about this before, but I mean traits such as pushing in front of others, being ruthlessly competitive, treating things like a zero-sum game, always looking at what's going on around us and being ready to react to that, rather than thinking long run about what we really want to achieve and what will truly make us fulfilled as individuals and as a society. A lot of this getting ahead style behaviour is not entirely my style, even though a lot of that is sort of inherent to doing business and to, well, the very nature of a competitive marketplace itself. And I hear this sentiment from other women too, this questioning of what we're meant to do to get ahead and whether we think that that's the right thing to be doing in the first place. Maybe it's something that some men question too. I have heard some men talk about this, and I'm keen to ask around more too. There's a real tie-in between masculinity and capitalism, and that's an entire episode itself that we'll come to soon. And it's not all negative either, let me state that up front. But yes, we're basically questioning the very foundations of the workplace. I'm based in the UK, and my two guests are from the US, so we're going to be talking about contexts that are relevant to us. Now, I'm going to keep it short because our first guest also has interesting ideas about this, about the nature of the economy itself, and all this talk about how the future is female. Eric Gady is a trained historian and a former Intel analyst. He questions the talk about women getting ahead in the workplace. He questions this not because he has any suspicions about women and their abilities, but rather because he has some deep misgivings about the very nature of work and our economies in the first place. I can really relate to his take, so I'll hand it over to him. He penned an essay which he's going to read. Here it goes.
I started seeing it shortly before the Women's March in D.C. this past January. I saw it on decals and posters and t-shirts done by women hip and plain, young and old. The future is female. It's the kind of consumer-friendly slogan that makes people tingle, an inspirational picture of text in one's Instagram feed. It's also vague enough that it can prompt multiple interpretations, much like any passage from an ancient religious text. And the priests of our own time have already begun sermonizing about it. They see the slogan as a clarion call to get more women into corporate leadership positions, the same ones currently dominated by men. This take lacks all imagination. For example, the number of male CEOs in Fortune 500 companies dwarfs the number of females. But as Forbes reported earlier this year, those female CEOs make more on average than their male counterparts. If this seems like some kind of victory, consider the more important fact. CEO compensation has risen over 900% since the 1970s. Pay for the median worker has barely budged in that same time period. Do we desire a future where women fill positions that men already have in a machine that perpetuates inequality? This Sheryl Sandbergian interpretation of the slogan wants to make the present female, not the future. Women only entered the workforce en masse in the 1970s and 80s at precisely the time when wages began to stagnate. Gone was the idea of a viable single-income household. But we also lost something else, an idea from feminist economics that attempted to redefine the very notion of the economy in the first place. It sought to discover ways to properly compensate for so-called non-market labor, activities such as home care, raising children, managing household accounts, all of the difficult and laborious work that the economy can barely account for, even today. Instead, women entered the grind in large numbers, wages continued to stagnate, and to this day, no one dares blaspheme our conception of the economy. Quite the opposite. Women matriculated into that pious, priestly class that had once been a boys-only club, one whose soul-defining purpose is to serve the caprices of their god, the market. The Sandbergians want women to catch up to the masculine head start, affixing more of their self-worth to employment and career. When that happens, neoliberalism will have swallowed all of us up whole. Men and women might be equals, sure, but equal gears in a dismal and increasingly outdated machine. If the future is to be truly female, we will need women to transcend the very state of affairs that make corporate executives such powerful positions in the first place. These women will need to ask, why do we structure our enterprises the way we do, and for whom is this still useful? It is imperative that women stand on the front lines of imagining new ways to organize society. Whether in or out, leaning is not the action that will usher in the future. Smashing, on the other hand, that may be the way to go. What I mean to say is, fewer Sheryl Sandbergs, more Rosa Luxemburgs. And perhaps women will prove to be the key factor in this change. As a political theorist Antonio Gramsci once wrote, the crisis consists in precisely the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. If anyone is going to birth the future, it's unlikely to be men. After all, they are constitutionally incapable of doing so alone.
I find almost everything Eric says to be pertinent. This questioning of whether I really want to get ahead in a system like the one he describes, a system rife with inequality and blind to the intricacies and nuances of what makes for a good life and what benefits society, and that maybe we should be questioning the very fundamentals of how we run our economies in the first place, rather than just focusing on having gender equality. By the way, Eric is also a good friend of mine, and he and I have poked fun at the sharing economy via our spoof company, MasterMe. Check it out in the links to this show. Question everything indeed. Anyway, this leads me to our next guest, who does this questioning daily. Jess Rimington is the managing director at The Rules. They're a collective who address the root causes of inequality, poverty, and climate change. She's also a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Global Project Center, where she looks into new methods of innovation. So Jess is well placed to talk about rethinking everything that we do. Now, Jess was a guest on the previous episode of this podcast. She and I had a fun chat about masculine and feminine energies, which are concepts that come up on this podcast a lot. We're going to be going into a lot of that now, but when we talk about a more feminine economy, we're not talking about necessarily having more women in the economy, but rather about having more so-called feminine traits present in how we actually work. We talked about this in the previous episode, but to quickly recap here, feminine traits include things such as openness, intuition, empathy, being able to see the other side and cross boundaries. And what we class as masculine traits are things such as determination, being assertive, being decisive, having a sense of direction. Neither is better than the other. We need both, rather than having more of one or the other. I'll leave you with Jess Rimington as we try to untangle what a more feminine economy looks like.
I think the feminine workplace looks like an environment that really values emergence and creates the conditions for that to be possible. And what I mean by that is that we work in a way where we're in full recognition that ideas and insights can come from any corner of the room, any space, that can be communicated in any way. And we're very intuitively and attunely aware and very open to the fact that the way in which we're doing something will imbue the outcome. The future is really now, if you think that the means are the ends. That means that the process in which we get to an outcome, the way in which we do a process, the type of facilitators we bring in for a project, the way we talk with each other, the way we organize ourselves, the timeline in which we deliver work deliverables, that all of those micro decisions determine the outcome, not in terms of whether it will be achieved, but the quality, the characteristics that are imbued upon it.
Can you think of a company or a workplace which exists at present and how that company or workplace would look if it had more feminine qualities to it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's take the company Uber, for example. They've crowdsourced and asked for insight from their drivers before. It's to make the product better, and the idea is that eventually that might trickle down and make the drivers' lives better too, in terms of they may make more money, etc. A more feminine approach to that, in my opinion, would be to really think about collaboration and co-creation in its truest form, and fairness as well, and to think about what would it look like to share profits with drivers, commensurate with their degree of contributed insight that's implemented.
So at present, it's more that Uber collects all this information, and it's basically so that Uber knows how to make more profit.
Right, without sharing that with the drivers.
Right, okay.
So very extractivist.
Okay, it's not in the interests of the drivers, at least.
I mean, I think they're argument would be that it is, because if the company's better and the product's better, then it should be better for the drivers too. So I'm not sure I would argue that it's not at all in the interest of the drivers to make the product better, but I would argue that it's not a very feminine approach to not take collaboration all the way the line of profit sharing. And I think that's one of the primary places in which we see an over-masculinization, and that's not to say that masculinity leads to lack of fairness or lack of equity or anything like that. Of course it doesn't. It's just any of these qualities out of balance leads to harmful systems. In our current patriarchal society, from what I can see, we talk a lot about collaboration and co-creation and emergence and innovation, but we only take that right to the line of what would keep us within the current patriarchal system. So we never push completely outside of the envelope, and we just take it right to the line of where we would actually be changing the system and actually be systematizing in more feminine qualities to our work environments. And one example of that would be real profit sharing and looking at cooperative structures, not in terms of just co-ops as entity, but what is true cooperation for innovation and for, I don't know what Silicon Valley might call quote unquote progress. What would that look like?
But let's go back to Uber. Uber gets all this data on how to improve its product, and hopefully that leads to a better product and higher profits. Mm-hmm. And not enough of that goes back to drivers.
There's not a direct through line at all between, and this is with most co-creation efforts within our current system, between what you contribute and knowing once you contribute how it's used, what decision-making authority is like, and then let alone what your share of the returns might be. If you're sharing insight, you're a decision maker too. And it's not that we don't value certain kinds of expertise, but we're rethinking what co-creation looks like. And I guess that's really the crux of it for me, is that the more feminine a work environment, the more we're really looking critically at what co-creation can mean, not just what it's meant to date.
And co-creation meaning what, though, for people who are sort of not in the innovative world?
How do we source insights and ideas from people across the entire supply chain, and including the end user, to enhance design and implementation?
So you've been in the workplace for over a decade. Mm-hmm. Are there sort of examples of companies you've been in or workplaces you've seen which have made you question the nature of the workplace and have led you to thinking about what it would mean to have more feminine qualities mm-hmm. within the workplace?
Definitely. The things that always hit home most for me are when you're in workplaces or environments or meetings where there's one way of thinking and one type of communication that's over-accentuated and overvalued to, in my observation and opinion, the disadvantage of the effort. I've seen this play out in my own life in examples of extreme expert bias, where we need the information to come from a technical sounding voice with very rational linear thinking, and we think these attributes of rational linear thinking are normatively positive. If something is rational, that means it's more sane, that means it's more good. If something's linear, that means it's more Western, that means it's more good. And you can, of course, draw those roots back directly to colonialization and of why that's the dogma right now across our economic system in large ways globally. But how it plays out, I think, the disadvantage of some of my own work experiences is that you shut out voices that could really lead to innovation and opinions just because they're expressed slightly differently and just because they are speaking from places of intuition and non-linear world thinking and but relational worldviews.
I wonder even if it's more about experience, because when you say all that, I'm nodding because it's making me think of working in a newsroom, right? And anything that happens is quickly like, I don't know, there's like some disease outbreak, right? So we're like, let's get someone from the WHO or whatever to give us a quote from their office in Geneva or something. Right. And sometimes you're sitting there thinking, I want to like chat to a doctor on the ground. I don't know, someone whose family member has died. And I find like the better journalists are those who do that. It's not just like, let's get an expert, which is often like, let's be honest, a white guy in a suit.
Exactly.
Who is like somewhere far away from the situation. It's funny you say about the rational thing, because it's almost as though the thinking is more important than people's actual experiences.
Totally.
So it's more
their expression of the thinking even.
Right, exactly. So, and it also leads to sort of intellectualization. So it's like with my same example, there's been some big outbreak of some disease. So let's talk to someone about numbers and statistics and what this is going to mean like 5 years down the line for the economy, rather than
how do people... Obviously that's the bottom line, we're all curious.
The economy? Yeah. Sally, it's all about the economy, right? Rather than, yeah, how do people feel? How is it affecting them?
Mm-hmm. What does their body tell them to be true? What did the land say to them? What did they learn from their ancestors?
It makes me wonder if there's a sort of fear of the natural world in all of this.
I think there's certainly a fear of feminine energy and feminine power. To be in balance is so much more powerful. And I think that it's a very safe, sterile world to just listen to rational thinking, and we can pretend that economics is real in the way we teach it. We can pretend that like the economy is this real sentient thing that we can prioritize and talk to. But if we really were to expand our vision to look at the whole breathing body that we live on and this like floating pale blue dot in space, then these things would seem like child's play in comparison. And then people's entire identities and worldviews and what they've committed their life to would, I think, even though they wouldn't be fully invalidated, I think feel invalidated. And that's scary. Scary fucking shit for people.
Well, that reminds me of, I remember reading this interview with Robert Reich. And I don't want to quote him because I will get the quote wrong. So it's something in the vicinity of this. The interview asked something about like labor and labor rights, and Robert Reich says something, and the interview is like, isn't that bad for the economy? And Robert Reich says something along the lines of, I think you're missing the point. The economy exists for us. We don't exist for the economy.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Actually, I think it's fantastic.
Right, which is, and that's a very feminine viewpoint, right? In terms of what are we here to do? We're here to, the whole reason we're doing any of this shit is just to self-organize as communities of one, of a certain species, to survive and to have some beautiful moments before we pass on and whatever we believe happens from there. And if you really take that approach, then why not expand the whole tool belt of survival and thinking rather than just stick in one very pinpointed notion and short-sighted way of thinking that's largely was propagated from enlightenment forward by a certain type of
dude.
White man.
Certain type of dude.
I mean, like, I'm not putting my money on that shit.
So a certain type of dude, I hate to say this, who probably just couldn't deal with his feelings, so I had to,
like... Yeah, and then found some friends, yeah.
But yeah. Without me being silly. What do you mean by feminine qualities that would also apply to the workplace and how we run our entire economy?
Things that would scare people is the first thought that came into my head. Especially when you say run the entire economy. But so important, right? If we're going to survive. Intuition, understanding intuition, valuing it, knowing that it's just as valid and worthy as important and important as hard science. And hard science is just as valid and worthy as intuition. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, yin and yang. It means recognizing that power isn't finite, that the whole concept of abundance is that power is not a zero-sum game. It means creation. I mean, from a very basic level, it's obviously those gendered female with female genitalia have the ability to help with creation through womb. I mean, that concept can be, whatever, metaphysically transposed onto workplace environments too. It means really honoring the process, the way of creation, the rootedness of that.
I studied economics as an undergrad, mm-hmm. and maybe I'm imagining this, but I don't think I am. I remember a definition of economics that a lot of economists or textbooks and teachers would use would be the study of how to allocate scarce resources amongst different people, right?
Right. I remember that I studied economics in undergrad too.
Right. So I'm not...
Similar definition.
Right. So but basically that's kind of a lot of our models go back to that sort of...
The scarcity mindset.
Right, okay.
Right, which makes sense. I mean, humans have had a tough time of things, as any species, but...
Talking about the economy as a whole is also quite hard because, like, you know, you have so many different industries who deal with scarcity differently, right? So, mm-hmm. like, there are industries where scarcity is a big deal, so...
Totally.
They probably have to approach how they do business differently from, I don't know, the service sector or something.
But power and scarcity are different, right? Like, you can solve scarcity issues through sharing power. Yeah, so an example would be thinking about how can we share decision-making power? How can we share creative power with more types of people than we normally do in the current system? Particularly, I would say, like, fundamentally when it comes to problems as urgent as actual scarce resources. And there's actually some amazing examples of this in disaster relief, of mm-hmm. thinking about when we are actually in situations of trauma and extreme resource scarcity, when things are life or death, all the protocol and Western colonized white man rational system shit kind of gets thrown out the window if it's not useful in that moment. And we come together and do anything we know how with whoever shows up and whoever has insight, and we start trusting outside of the construct of what we've learned to trust in the workplace to survive. We listen differently. We listen to the person with local knowledge. We listen to the grandmother in the room, what she has to say. We think and act relationally because it is all we have. And those people talk back on those moments. There's examples of Katrina and after the San Francisco earthquake earlier in the century of people remembering that time period as both trauma and also as this totally different life experience they've ever had of working differently.
But so something like Katrina, what are ways in which a variety of voices were being heard? Not only was it a natural disaster, but it seemed to be like an organizational disaster as well, responding.
That's true too, yeah.
Responding to like what had happened.
So I'm talking more on the ground of like literally how do you get people mm-hmm. out of homes, off of roofs, into helicopters? How does a neighbor become suddenly a chef for 200 people? Often very masculine, systematized forces that failed. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them being systemic racism in the case of Katrina, of course. But one of the really beautiful examples of something that happened a little bit right after the immediate disaster relief effort in Katrina was the effort for reconstruction and how would that happen. There was, I think it's like 4 plans that had federal funding attached to them. I might have some of the details wrong here, but that had failed to do a unified New Orleans resiliency and reconstruction plan. And there was a lot of money thrown at those. And then a group of community foundations and a small architecture firm and community design firm called Concordia ended up kind of stepping up from a community-based organizing perspective and organized 9,000 people across the diaspora to be decision-making authority and creative planners and how their neighborhoods would be reorganized and reconstructed. And it worked. And the reason, in my opinion, it worked is because that circle was expanded in terms of the number of voices and really conscious ways to check and overcome expert bias.
But I'll be honest, when you talk of something like Katrina, that's like this disaster situation. Mm-hmm. And so often, like, you know, even in your personal life, when disaster happens, the rule book goes out the window, right? You've got to do what you can to survive. And in a way, what you're describing, though, makes it sound like we should be practicing survival mode ways of doing things, mm-hmm. even when it's like everything is fine and dandy. When we try and be more systematic and stuff, isn't that because we want to make things better, do things more properly, mm-hmm. be more thorough? And again, with experts as well. I mean, I complain about experts in my profession a lot, but then I don't know enough about anything to be able to give a meaningful opinion about what should be done in X situation. I hate to say it, what you describe sounds like a bit of, it could be a mess or something.
Yeah, if done poorly, it could be a mess for sure, like anything. I mean, I'm certainly not advocating to throw out expertise out the window. I think there's a huge place for experts, and it's around really figuring out how do we include expert voices and expand our definition of expertise. Mm-hmm.
So that it's not just sort of academic expertise,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I think when you and I use the term expert and expert bias, we're talking about a specific looking, speaking type of person giving type of information being given.
Which is basically mostly educated white men in the West.
Right. Or those who have most associated themselves with those attributes and learn to speak that way. Women do this all the time, right? My personal opinion is we should be looking anywhere where there's breakout innovation happening, anywhere where things are happening differently and getting better results. I personally want to learn from that.
Are there problems that exist within the global economy that you can clearly pinpoint to overly masculine qualities and behaviors?
I think there are problems that exist on Earth that can be clearly pinpointed to the global economy as the cause. That came from a set of conditions and ways of thinking and mindset that is overly masculine and patriarchal and colonialist.
What would be our description? Like not listening to all voices, being top down, not being inclusive about innovation and ideas, that sort of thing?
All of that, and I think at the fundamental root of it is that seeing that there's an other.
It kind of sounds like you're saying that maybe the masculine way of doing things is about taking and dictating and giving orders from above, and maybe the feminine is more about sort of thinking of others, thinking of our interaction with nature even. So it's more about sort of relationships in a way, right? Our relationships between bosses and workers, production and the environment.
Totally. And I think all of that, though, relates to just kind of one root thing, if I had to name one thing, and that's this concept that there is an other. As soon as we start thinking that there is a category of other, then that creates huge systemic issues. And I think that at the root of patriarchy, at the root of over-masculine qualities, is that construct. If there is an other, then
that construct that we don't see the other?
That we have created an other, that there is an other at all. Okay. That there's not a oneness, right?
So that's the problem of patriarchy, that an other is created.
I think that's the root cause of a lot of the problems of patriarchy, yeah.
What is an example in the business world, for example, or in the world of work?
if there is an other, then I can feel I'm better than that other, and I can feel I'm more worthy, and that it's okay to extract from, to abuse, to subjugate that other, to justify those means to get my ends of profit.
Okay.
So it's okay if I'm having sweatshops and child labor. It's okay if my mining company is shooting down miners, because this is this category of other. And what matters most is my profits and my quote-unquote people over here obtaining the products and goods and services they need. And I think that if we had a balanced workplace, that way of thinking would be fundamentally impossible.
But it's interesting what you're saying, because that even feeds into the nature of competition, right?
Exactly.
So even like, I don't know, company A is better than company B, rather than company A and B can coexist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So basically we need to rethink the entire economy.
Probably, if we're going to survive, yeah.
Because a lot of what you're saying, it really goes to the root of how we think of improving things and innovating and, you know, just running our economy. It's kind of, and we talk about competition, which is such an inherently male thing, you know, like, you know, having to prove one's self-worth. It's kind of all like a self-worth issue, maybe.
Probably at the root of it. Yeah, I think we're an extremely insecure society.
So a more feminine workplace would basically mean it's not so much about competition. It's more thinking about what we're doing, taking everyone's experiences into account, listening to people more. What's the most feminine workplace you can think of that actually exists right now?
The workplace environment of the Standing Rock movement. If that wasn't a workplace environment, I don't know what else is. There is a goal, urgency, labor, a lot of intent, and a mission. So Standing Rock was a movement based within the United States and started late July 2016 after Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners informed the Standing Rock Sioux Nation that in 5 days they would begin construction on a section of the Dakota Access Pipeline, so an oil pipeline, next to the reservation. And so once that was announced, it started with just about 200 members of different Native American tribes and their allies came to try to block that effort from happening. And then it grew into thousands of people that came from around the U.S. and around the world to be protectors of the water and to protect the land and the water from being polluted and contaminated and damaged by the pipeline's construction.
So how is that a more feminine workplace?
The way people worked, from what I've heard, and this is just my own research, I wasn't there, was super unique in terms of thinking about this issue. And part of that was really grounding in the idea that imagining the effort had already been won and not being that scarcity mindset, even though conditions were extreme, and really embodying the belief and faith and disposition, acting qualities of how you just behave every day as though they had already won. And if you can imagine if we did that in the workplace rather than we're so fearful of the competition and the scarcity and our colleague next to us who, you know, maybe is competing with us or whatever for the same job slot, if we just accepted that.
So basically the big problem with the way we run our economies is that we're insecure. We need to act less insecure.
Basically, I think we're pretty insecure as a species right now.
And a more feminine workplace is more about trusting that the world will give and that we can listen to each other and that isn't a threat to each of us. If we listen to each other and get different points of view and trust ourselves as well.
And we can share power and we can listen to different types of voices and expertise. And that's what you saw at Standing Rock was people both valuing the technical expertise as well as elder wisdom, as well as new young voices, also connecting to the power of even prayer and being able to think about where do you need to go on this land to get the information we might need to be able to think about a creative solution. What's the way to be able to access that guidance? This stuff can look like going to an office. It can look like ending work at 5. It can look like...
But you just listen to your coworker and to other people and you're not threatened by it and wanting to compete all the time and
just more open. So fucking insecure, like you said, you know? Stop thinking you got to hold on so tight or the whole world's going to fall apart. Because if you keep holding on tight, you know what? The world just may fall apart if it hasn't already.
You heard from Jess Remington and Eric Gady on this edition of The Gender Knot, where we explored what a more feminine economy looks like. Now, next week we'll have something short and sweet before another long episode on August 28th. That's in a fortnight. I'm actually not yet sure what either of these episodes will be about. There's a few different topics being recorded right now, so we'll just trust in the abundance of the universe and see which ones we end up with. Until then, please leave a review on iTunes. I love getting your feedback and it helps the podcast enormously. I've also been having some great conversations with some of you about what you've heard and about ideas of things to be untangled in upcoming episodes. If you've got thoughts or if you want to be on the podcast, then drop us a line at thegenderknot@gmail.com or head over to Facebook and find our page and send a message that way. Okay, speak to you next week. Stay abundant and rethink everything. Bye for now.